The Crude Life with host Jason Spies.
Sarah, could you state your name and whatever company or title that you would like to kind of be referred to? And I do it for a mic level check, and then also for when I kind of do the writing and stuff, so I have the title down. Sometimes for pronunciation. Boy, that's always fun to mispronounce that word. Nothing could possibly go wrong. So that's impossible. Go ahead in 3, 2, 1.
My name is Sarah Stogner, and I own the law firm Stogner Legal.
Thank you for joining the program here today via our Zoom line. And boy, exciting stuff happening all over the country, but it's the Halloween season, so we're going to get into some zombie wells and probably talk a little abandoned and orphan wells too to stay on the theme. But Sarah Stogner ran for Republican in the Texas Railroad Commission, and she had a very successful campaign. It was a social media campaign, and in the primary, she ended up getting a one-on-one second ballot, which she was unsuccessful, and Texas Railroad incumbent Wayne Christian continues onto the ballot. So I wanted to ask you, first off, before we get into the zombie wells, do you still stay active then with kind of the race and everything, or after that that runoff where Wayne was successful, did you just kind of say, well, that's it, I'm just going to go focus on my legal practice? Just kind of give me a little summary of kind of where you're at with the political part of your life, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, no, you know, I think I've never wanted to be a politician, right? And so, blessings in disguise. I'm hopeful that I'm actually going to get more done to help move the Texas energy industry forward out of office over the next 2 years than I would have if I'd been in office. They're 6-year terms, right? There's 3 commissioners. So I plan to run again against, if Christy Craddock runs, against her. If she doesn't, then I'll run anyways. But so in 2 years, I plan on running again. I've actually publicly endorsed the Democratic candidate, Luke Warford, who has a real shot of winning. He's only 4 points behind. So it is anybody's race. And I think the fact that Wayne did not get a majority of the votes in any of the Permian, in either of the March 1st primary or the May 24th runoff, to me indicates that the industry itself recognizes that we need change, and that we can't continue to, you know, essentially say that everything's fine, nothing's wrong, you know, we got to stop climate denying, we got to stop all this ridiculousness. And I think that there is an appetite for real change within the industry. So a long-winded way of saying, I may not be officially on the ballot or involved in politics at the moment, but I'm not going away.
Next week, I will be speaking at the Minnesota Schools Public Relations Association. It's their annual meeting. It's going to be like, you know, 900 public relation professionals from every school across the state of Minnesota. And I'm going to be presenting some of our social media work that we've been doing for the past 6 months. And there's a couple examples I'm going to give, and you are one of the examples I'm going to give up there about, and I'm not going to have the famous TikTok video, although I will mention it. It's going to be more about your social media platform campaign, how you took it, how you reinvented politics. To me, you are an example of how social media has completely changed the political landscape, in the same way that in 2009, myself and another gentleman, Kevin Tabosa, did the social media platform for the city of Fargo when they went through their flood. And so it was for First Link, a nonprofit. So the two people who did all the work, actually Kevin did all the work. I just kind of did all the note taking and, you know, kind of added in and that sort of thing. But Kevin was the lead, and he was actually got a story in the state of Washington. Their newspaper did a story on him because he was the person behind the entire social media platform, which in a natural disaster boy, social media is like on steroids. And that happened in your campaign too. So talk to me about, what did you learn about social media from your campaign?
Yeah, so, you know, I really back up a little bit. I started making a concerted effort in 2017 to have a presence on LinkedIn, to really be an influencer on LinkedIn in the legal space so that I could start creating demand for my services from the people that I wanted to help, right? So as a lawyer, unfortunately the legal industry is one that doesn't like change, right? We're very much old school, just like oil and gas in a lot of ways. But so I started making a concerted effort to share myself in my personality and my thoughts on LinkedIn in 2017. So that was the start of it. So I already had kind of a jump start. I already had a platform. I already had an audience. I already had a professional following. And so I just stepped that up. And then last September, I think, I started my TikTok, because you have to, people are so, in this day and age, right, people's attention spans are very short and they are inundated with information. And so if you don't gather their attention in the first half of a second of a video or a post, they're going to keep scrolling. And I found that people, where I'm most successful is when I'm just 100% authentically me. And then I give people the option of whether or not they want to interact with me or not. And the people who like you and appreciate you and are drawn to you will be even more drawn to you. And the people who you aggravate, they're probably still going to be drawn to you too, because your haters watch you even more than the people that like you. And then they engage. And it's all about understanding how the algorithms boost content, how you can reach people that are likely voters, and then ultimately, hopefully, inspiring people to show up and vote. And so I don't have any data on what that looked like, right? Like here's however many followers I have, here's how many people voted. But at the end of the day, for example, I think we've got 18 million registered voters in Texas, and only 1 million showed up to vote in the Republican primary. So you're dealing with really low turnout, and you're just trying to create a name for yourself, because at the end of the day, people go to the ballot and they vote based on emotion and they vote based on name recognition. And so what I've done pretty successfully is able to generate organic media attention, right? And I don't have to pay for that. I'm not having to pay for advertisements. I'm not paying for flyers. I'm not doing any of the traditional things, because I'm out there making a name for myself independent, based on what I'm doing. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes total sense, because I've been in the media for over 30 years, so I understand completely. And one of my biggest beefs with the media over the last 10 years is there's less and less reporters that are leaving the office. They sit around on social media all day and follow people, and that's where they get a lot of their news. They wait to get their standard press releases from the Railroad Commission or, you know, the government bodies, and then they almost rerun those press releases word for word. And these are media outlets that do that. So, but they also get paid to do it too, because they get government money to, yeah. And so when someone like you comes along who doesn't have the money to give them, you have to do a lot. And that's why you are a shining example of how social media can actually break through. You can become a legitimate disruptor. You're the only disruptor I've seen down in Texas, to be honest. I know there's a lot of people who label themselves, but you're the only one that's gotten the endorsement from the San Antonio paper. And that does not happen unless you bring a lot of dollars to the table from, you know, the government or, you know, oil companies and et cetera, which you were very good about calling out. So I still, think you're an inspiration to many people out there. I know you have some people that are still dogging you because you are inspiring to others. What has your contemporaries thought about this, I guess, you know, because it is difficult sometimes to take a stand, and that's what you did. You took a stand against the industry, and Dave Chappelle, he had to go away for 12 years, you know, And right. yeah, and so he came back and he publicly flogged his industry to make it better. And Steve Bakken tells me all the time that one of my biggest issues in the Bakken is that, you know, I'm their best friend and their worst enemy at the same time. You know, we're trying to make them better by just expanding their mind a little bit to see the other side of things. You mentioned some of the old legal people don't want to change and oil and gas people don't want to change. And that's true. That is true. And so anyway, what are your contemporaries kind of take away from some of this, if you don't mind asking?
Yeah, no, I mean, I get a lot of really positive feedback, and I have people asking. I had a call this morning of a guy that's dealing with kind of an interesting pipeline issue. And so I help people strategize frequently. And I think my contemporaries in the beginning, what I was doing was incredibly scary because as lawyers, right, we always want, like, don't talk to the press, don't be public. We're always worried about being out there. And I've taken the exact opposite approach of when you're right and you have nothing to hide, be 100% transparent and be out there. And you may not always be right. Admit when you're wrong, move on. And that has served me very well. It's served my clients very well. And so I think that we're starting to see real results from non-traditional litigation. So
on our
well issue, right? It's like we're not getting the traction that we need with the regulators. I don't want to go to traditional court because that's where the Chevrons of the world are used to being. They will army up with an army of lawyers and they will drown us in legal ridiculousness, right? Because they know that game. So when you can't win the game that others have been playing, you create a new game. And that's what we're doing.
Let's talk about the game that you are creating now, because that is happening in other industries as well. And what's happening, this game, so to speak, is a whole new narrative is being carved out online. And that narrative is basically old school reporting, investigative reporting, which has really gone by the wayside. And as a media professional for 30 years, I feel qualified to say that. I'm a former publisher. I'm a former editor. Actually, I started in the newspaper business when I was 10 years old. I was a 1099 employee as a newspaper carrier. I had to collect money at night and deliver newspapers in the morning. So I worked every day for like 3 to 4 hours a day when I was 10 years old until I was 16. And so then I got traditional jobs after that. So, you know, I kind of hold the media a little bit responsible for some of this as well. So what you're doing, in my opinion, is old school journalism, but more from a guerrilla standpoint and the guerrilla marketing standpoint, the G-U-E-R-R spelling of it. And that's really connecting with the kids. That's really connecting with the millennials. And, you know, that to me shows what I've been saying for a long time. There is a market out there for the truth. And really, that's what, to me, it seems like you're trying to do. So tell the listeners out there kind of this you know, this guerrilla marketing / legal work / expose that you have going on through your social media channels, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, sure. So I think the best thing for people to do is go follow me and look. You know, you can, my newest venture is a TikTok account called Zombie Wells, WELLZ, because Zombie Wells with an S was already taken. But
Zombie Wells with a Z works better with the zombies.
Yeah, right, there you go.
Yeah.
So what I found is, especially on really technically complex well issues, right? I mean, things that are happening 3,000 or 10,000 feet below the ground, fluid dynamics, physics, engineering, right? Very technically complex issues. You have to make them interesting to the average person, and they have to be able to grasp what you're talking about. And so I can quickly start talking about hydrostatic heads and pressures and all these things, and people's eyes glaze over and they're lost. But if you show them a picture of a well that's got salt crystals all over it and black crude and it's bubbling gas, and you put some creepy TikTok music on it and you say, on today's episode of Zombie Wells, we introduce you to the Estes number 3. And I totally stole this from a lady who's been on TikTok for a long time, who in October does creepy lake months, or spooky lake months, she calls it. And so she does a deep geological dive into various water bodies, and she's fascinating. She's got over 1 million followers and she's great. And so how you do this on any subject matter is you find your niche, you get compelling visuals, and you match that with a little bit of education, and people want to learn. They're interested, and it makes it accessible and interesting and, you know, minute little tidbits. And so I'm actually going to follow up. We're in the process right now of creating a new website that people would, it'll be interactive, where they can go and click on a map and they'll be able to click and they'll be able to see pictures of the wellbores. They'll be able to get the old records, because everyone's looking at it from a different perspective, right? So if you've got an average citizen that has no idea about oil and gas, my goal isn't for them to start going learning the nuances of hydrostatic heads. It's for them to say, this is probably something that could be impacting my life. We all need groundwater. I'm going to talk to my neighbors about the election, or I'm, you know what I'm saying? I just want to get people interested. I want them to know what the Railroad Commission does, kind of thing. Whereas my motivation for the industry is very different. My motivation with the industry is I want every single subject matter expert who has something to contribute, that wants to know about this and wants to contribute, I want them to be able to access the information and then help us figure out what's actually going on, right? Like, so I'm in the unique circumstance of, we have these old wells that are, and I guess we should define zombie wells, right? We've got these wells that have been drilled
All right, hang on here. Let's pause for just a second here, yeah. Okay? Because I agree. I was going to interject when you took a breath, which is very difficult for you to do, I could tell, which I absolutely love because you're an attorney. So, folks, we're going to define three different types of wells. First one is orphan wells, and then we're going to define abandoned wells. And then the third term that popped up a couple years ago is zombie wells. So I wanted to find out, first of all, if my definition of zombie well matches what Sarah's definition is. So first of all, the standard definition for an abandoned well is when there's an unproductive well where they actually know whose well it is, so they can identify which company is attached to that well. An orphan well is where they just have no idea which operator is attached to it. And Curtis Shuck with the Well Done Foundation is doing a great job of capping orphan wells, which primarily are from, you know, the 1800s and the early 1900s, when there wasn't much regulation and they used like wood for oil derricks and things like that. So to have an orphan well in modern times in my world seems bizarre to me, but we can go on that in just a second. A zombie well to me, Sarah, I've always basically heard it's an upside down house. That yeah, they know who the operator is, but they need to keep it going, but it doesn't operate any money, and so they don't really pay attention to it. Define a zombie well, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, so I guess for me, the distinction is, and I'm going to tweak your orphaned well a little bit. They may know who drilled the well, but there's nobody available or around with the financial wherewithal to do anything about it, right? So Joe Blow's oil company went out of business in 1973. Joe Blow's gone. That well is orphaned. And so it can be, typically they're wells that were never plugged. So in my mind, a zombie well, or the way I've been using it over the past couple of years, is these are wells whose downhole condition has not been confirmed. Maybe it's been reported as plugged and abandoned. Maybe it's been reported as just temporarily abandoned and they never came back and plugged it. Maybe it's shut in, whatever. But you don't have enough of the data to know what's happening downhole. and they are bouncing back to life. They are springing back to life, coming back from the dead because of the increased water injection that we're doing now as a result of the shale revolution. That water has to go somewhere. And we inject it deep and it causes earthquakes. We inject it shallow and it comes into contact with shallower aquifers. And these wells have casing that's been rotting and cement that may or may not have ever been there. And suddenly you've got these wells and they become unkillable when that flow is from shallow enough. And then you have to go into all the nerdy hydrostatic heads. But for my purposes, and the reason I chose Zombie Wells out where we are in the Central Basin platform of the Permian Basin is because all of the new horizontal drills in the Midland Basin and the Delaware Basin, as a necessity, the reason we frack is because they don't have the porosity, right? So you can't just re-inject the water that comes out through a water flood like we have been in traditional vertical wells. And that water has to go somewhere. And so they're piping it or trucking it to disposals in the Central Basin platform. They're injecting it into the San Andreas Formation, specifically in the Central Basin platform, which in some places is an oil and hydrocarbon producing zone, and in other cases it's not, but it has become overpressurized. You see it in the new 4 and 5 string casing designs that they're talking about as they're drilling these new horizontals in the Permian. And so we're encountering much higher pressures, shallower, and it is bringing these old wells back to life.
Water always finds its own level. So you mentioned it's a lot of this is these are wells that have been unproductive for years that are bouncing back to life because of the, you know, like I said, water is going to find its level and it's going to find underneath. And so just through the natural progression of water moving underground, that's what's bringing these back to life.
Yeah, they are over injecting into these shallower disposal wells at like 3,000 feet, and they fractured the formation. It's compounding, right, Jason? It's 70 years of sloppy construction, lack of maintenance, and it's biting us in the butt. And we cannot continue to kick the can down the road. I don't think it's fair for us to impose our 2022 knowledge on what these guys were doing in the 50s and 60s. But now that we know better, we have to recognize that we've got a problem and say, okay, maybe they should have done better, but they didn't know better in the past. Once we know better, we have to do better. And that's where we're at.
So this is an article from The Guardian, 2021. The situation isn't much better elsewhere in the Permian Basin. Texas and New Mexico have already identified about 7,000 abandoned wells that were once operated by over 1,000 companies. State officials estimate these will cost $335 million to plug. Again, that was 2001 numbers. The state defines wells as orphaned if they do not have an approved operator on record. Additionally, Texas only includes wells that haven't produced in at least a year. Where are we at today with these? Do you know how many orphan wells or abandoned wells or these types of wells are in Texas in the Permian right now?
Yeah. It depends on who you ask. When you ask the Railroad Commission, magically that 8,000 number seems to be in perpetuity the number of orphaned wells on their orphaned well list. I estimate it's probably over 100,000. If you look at core test wells and other holes in the ground. And don't forget, we've got over 100,000 right now in the state of Texas that have been shut in and that haven't produced, in several months. And I think if you look at ones that haven't produced, and Commission Shift has all these statistics, so I don't want to misquote them.
No, it's
okay.
They've
got an excellent report. But basically, there's 150,000 wells right now where operators, they're still on operators' books. Those operators still have a P5 license to operate, but they're letting these wells just sit and rot. And so we have got to stop the bleeding. We've got to say, okay, and I think if you look at the bonding, something like the bonding only covers 15% of the anticipated cost to plug all of the wells out there that need to be plugged under today's current inventory of wells.
I want to ask you about bonds. In North Dakota, they have to put down a bond. Finding out it really depends on whose property it's on and which operator, because it varies from $10,000 to $150,000 for these bonds. And so, you know, some people don't have to pay very much. Some people have to pay a lot more. And what's it like in Texas? Do you guys have a bond system down there for these abandoned orphan zombie wells?
We do. Unfortunately, we have a blanket bonding system. And so the maximum bond that any operator is required to post is $250,000. So the Chevrons of the world have one $250,000 bond at the Railroad Commission that's supposed to cover the thousands of well bores.
Are you kidding me?
No.
Oh, it's oh, wow. So it's like when you go to a hotel and they charge you for the pet for the week instead of each night. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. So, oh, wow, I didn't even realize that. No wonder they have such an issue down there. Oh, my word. Oh, my flirt. wow, that seems a little antiquated. Has that ever been brought up as something to change?
Oh, yeah. Operators have fought against increasing bonding.
You know, well, of course, I would too. If I was an operator, I'd fight that all day long.
Right?
Oh, that would change your bottom line overnight. Holy smokes!
Yeah, but like, there's two different issues here, right? And I think I agree that for existing wells, that would be essentially it would bankrupt a lot of small operators.
Overnight, right? Absolutely. Yes.
You don't want to do.
Yes.
But for new drills, if you're drilling a $10 million new horizontal well, I'm sorry, you need to put $100,000 in that AFE and you need to invest it. And then the interest can go and it can work to do something else. It can, you know, whatever. But when you drill a new well, you need to be able to have the money, and that bonding money needs to stay with that API number. That well bore, you drill that well, and then we know we could stop the bleeding right now for these future problems. Okay, then we're going to have to come up with something that addresses the you know, millions of holes that we've already put into the ground. And so I don't know of a good way to fix that other than taking care of the water problem, right? If we take care of our over-injection of water, we're injecting 15 million barrels per day of produced water in the Permian Basin alone, and close to 30 million in the state of Texas. That if we stopped injecting all of this water and actually started recycling it and reusing it, stopped using fresh water, we could significantly reduce the number of well failures and the underground contamination that's ongoing. So I don't think it all needs to be on the stripper well operators to go in and shore up their old wells. They shouldn't have to shore up their wells against ridiculous subsurface pressures that are artificially created by the SWDs. And that's where we're at.
So I'm up here in Williston this week in North Dakota in the Bakken at actually at Train ND, talking to a lot of people going through different training. And one of the things that I've heard, you know, off the record multiple times, and I see we just got about 10 minutes left here, multiple times, is that, you know, if everybody along the way just followed the procedures and everything, these OSHA codes and XYZ, there'd never be a blowout. And I always say, well, you know, maybe 1 out of 1,000 or something like that, you know, because you can never say 100%, it seems. Talk to me a little bit about that regulation side of things. Is this a regulatory issue? Is this a sloppy workforce issue? Is this a good old boy country club issue that they just keep dumping money into a company that, you know, is so-and-so's kid and doesn't matter if he messes up, as long as his business is taken care of, we can move it ahead and that type of thing? What's the issue down there?
Yes, all of the above. I mean, I think the biggest issue that I see is a more recent disconnect between the money and the operations.
Yeah.
Right? And so unless and until these Wall Street guys actually come down and look and understand at what they're doing, and we get intellectually honest about the fact that there's a lot of leases out there that are on the books as having a positive value, but they don't. They are liabilities. And unless and until we actually start enforcing the regulations that are intended to protect our groundwater, you know, to make sure that the surface casing has integrity. But you still don't have to cement all of your casing strings in Texas. Like, you don't have to confirm the top of cement. And so there's no bond logs required. We're converting old producing wells into injection wells without any sort of CBLs, right? I mean, Norway, I think, requires a confirmation of a bond at 90% for the cement bond log. So, you know, unless and until we actually enforce the regulations that are on the books, which we don't, and then shore up some of the regulations that need to be updated, like the cement, it's never going to get better. But at the end of the day, you have companies like these super majors who have political pressure from their investors to get out of oil and gas. So they're dumping old assets on smaller operators who don't have the balance sheet to come in and plug and remediate. And so you've got to look at the life of the well and when does it become economically, you know, more expensive to properly decommission it than the future production of that well. And if you're doing an actual honest assessment of that, there's a lot of assets across the country that are bigger liabilities than they are assets, but no one's actually factoring that in and properly accounting for that. And so that's a systemic problem. And, you know, you get these private equity backed companies, for example, that come in, they buy up the leases, they drill a few wells, they prove up the production, and then they flip it. And so as long as you have companies that are flipping assets and you let funds go out of business, or, you know, they just convert it into the next iteration, then you're creating shell companies and liability shields that at the end of the day, we need to do what they do in Louisiana for this part and offshore. And that if you've ever owned a working interest in that well, you should be required to come back in and plug that well. And if we would start saying, okay, like if Chevron transfers it to a little tiny operator and that little tiny operator goes out of business, then the next person in title that's around should have to come back and fix that well. But unless and until we actually start enforcing the rules, right, then people are going to continue to game the system.
Just a couple minutes left with Sarah Stogner, America's energy influencer. She's also known as the Unicorn Lawyer. And we've got, just like I mentioned, just a couple minutes left on the Zoom here. But I did want to read something to you because I think this is a good way to end. We're talking about zombie wells. We're talking about abandoned wells. We're talking about orphan wells. Some of the issues that persist with the regulatory side of things and just the disconnect that's happening more and more. And what the locals are dealing with here, and this is what I wanted to read from this article and just kind of summarize it, if you wouldn't mind. A few miles east of her ranch, leaks from abandoned wells have formed a toxic sulfuric lake that is three times saltier than the Gulf of Mexico. What is happening here with the actual landowners and the property? What is the impact having on the people in the community?
Increased cancer rates, can't farm, can't ranch cows. If we don't fix this, the Permian Basin is going to be uninhabitable in 20 years. Like, that's where we're at.
Well, how can people follow you, get in touch with you, all kinds of things? We'll have the links on the show page, but let's go ahead and people out there listening, yes, in radio land and in podcast land, how can people follow you and support your cause?
Yeah, well, I am Sarah Stogner, S-T-O-G-N-E-R. You can find me on LinkedIn. I am Sarah_E_unicorn on Instagram, and that's my personal Twitter. If you want to follow that, I have that protected. If you want to follow my official, more proper Twitter, it's Sarah4RRC. And then on TikTok, I am the Unicorn Lawyer and Zombie Wells with a Z.
Interested in becoming a sponsor? Email studio@thecrudelife.com.